Tokyo Podcast episode number 48.
On this show, we talk to documentary filmmaker Paul Johannesson about his latest film titled Ishinomaki Then and Now. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we're going to talk about the small town of Ishinomaki. Ishinomaki is a small city located a few hours north of Tokyo, has a population of about 164,000 people, so very small. But it has the distinction of being one of the hardest hit areas during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. And on this particular show, what I kind of wanted to focus on wasn't so much the devastation and all the tragedy that has happened there, which I think has been covered quite a bit already. But I wanted to talk about a documentary that I came across about the town of Ishinomaki, showing the devastation, the recovery, but more importantly, it talks to the people that live in the city, in the town. And this is something I haven't seen a lot of online. Maybe in Japanese media they've covered it, but I haven't seen that. But in from Western media, I haven't seen a lot of footage of people who actually went through it and who've interviewed and have told their story. So in this show, we're going to talk to filmmaker Paul Johannesson, who recently completed his documentary titled Then and Now, about Ishinomaki and what it went through and how it is now. So I'm looking forward to talking to him a little bit later on in the show. Before we get to Paul, I quickly wanted to talk about a recent trip I took up to the small ski resort of Niseko on the northern island of Hokkaido. And I gotta say, what a cool little ski town this place is. Niseko is famous for its powder snow. There's actually four ski areas all around this little tiny town. And the locals tell me that when it starts snowing there, it will snow for like 2 weeks straight, day and night. And it's not unusual to have, you know, totally clear ground one day, and then a few days later, you got 10 feet of powder snow everywhere. So it's a really neat little town. One thing I was really surprised at, actually, is how much English was spoken there. I think traveling in Japan outside of the kind of the main city hubs is difficult for a lot of tourists because there's almost no English spoken at all. And the travel infrastructure is not really designed for foreigners. And even when Japanese people tell you that they themselves find it difficult to figure out where to go, you can kind of imagine what it's like if you don't understand the language. But I was really surprised in Niseko of how many people spoke English. A lot of the businesses, a lot of the stores and everything spoke English, so it was no problems at all. But what's really cool about this place, though, is the powder snow. It's really famous for its dry powder snow. And I think right now, Niseko is not really on the map of as a top ski destination. It's kind of a hidden gem. But I think that's all going to change in the next couple of years because last year, Warren Miller came and shot a video at Niseko. So you can bet that once Warren Miller starts to visit ski resorts, everything changes, right? All the tourists come in and pretty much ruins the mountain and all the enthusiasts have to go somewhere else. But if you're thinking about taking a ski vacation this year, you want to try something totally different. And you're looking for some amazing powder snow. Like this place has got no problems at all with snow. And you know, you can't say that for a lot of other top ski resorts. I remember even skiing at Whistler Blackcomb many times. Half the mountain would be green. They got snow making machines going like crazy. So this place, definitely not a problem with that. They got, you know, 10 feet of powder snow everywhere all the time. So if you're thinking about going someplace unique, I definitely recommend checking out the ski resort of Niseko on the northern island of Hokkaido. The The small city of Ishinomaki, with a population of just over 160,000 people, was one of the hardest hit by the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. Approximately half of the city was flooded by the tsunami, with some neighborhoods having 80% of their homes destroyed. My guest today is Mr. Paul Johannesson, who is a documentary filmmaker whose latest film, Then and Now, looks at the devastation that was caused by the tsunami and the recovery efforts by the citizens of Ishinomaki to rebuild their city. Hi, Paul. Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me on board.
You're welcome. Now, I watched your film recently, and I got to tell you, I was blown away by it. I've seen a number of films about the earthquake, but I thought yours was absolutely fantastic. Cinematography was great. I love the cast of characters. Can you give the audience kind of a brief background about how you came to film this documentary about this particular city?
There's a global documentary project called One Day on Earth. It's a big kind of crowdsourced project that I've been involved with. The first one that happened happened on the 10th of the 10th, 2010. And you go out and you film something and you send your footage to these guys and they would edit it into a kind of slice of life, One Day on Earth kind of documentary. So it came around to the next year, which was 11th of November, 2011. And I was living in Tokyo and I thought, we've got to do something for this. I wanted to do something for this project again, so we really have to do something that's related to the tsunami and the tragedy up there in Tohoku. So through a friend of mine who'd been involved in a bunch of aid stuff, we ended up in Ishinomaki because we had some connections to some local residents who were very active in the kind of rebuilding, in trying to rebuild their town. And we're very kind of outspoken characters that my friend really knew would work well in a documentary. So we went up there originally to shoot for this project One Day on Earth, and we came back with so much footage that we thought, oh, we have to just cut something ourselves. This is so strong and powerful, this stuff. We have to make a piece of our own and just put it out there. So we did it. We did both.
Oh, interesting. When you went up there for the first time, what was your reaction? How long after the earthquake were you up there?
So this is 8 months to the day that we were up there. That's the first time I'd been up there. I'd been involved on a couple of other sort of aid fundraising videos and things just as an editor before. So I'd spent some time cutting footage that other people had shot. And that was an experience in itself. But to actually stand there, even 8 months later and see just how trashed everything was. It was shocking.
Well, so your footage that you shot is 8 months after.
Yeah. So there are a couple of opening shots that we do date as April. I didn't shoot that. A friend of mine had been up there and he just gave me permission to incorporate that footage into the film. So all the interviews and the majority of the footage after the opening minute or so is from 8 months later, yes.
Wow.
But the very opening shots of the most sort of horrific devastation was from about a month after the event.
One of the things that I particularly liked about your film was the interviews that you did with the residents of the city there. How did you get them to talk on camera? Because I know Japanese people are notoriously camera shy. Was it a bit of an effort? Was it a struggle to get them to talk on camera?
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I've heard it so many other times that it can be difficult for Japanese people to do it. I think one, we were three guys in the crew who were all foreigners. So for them, for Japanese people, I think they relax immediately then because they don't feel the need to hold the cultural kind of, they don't need to keep face in the same way as they would if we were a Japanese crew from a Japanese TV station.
Right.
So for them, maybe they felt like, oh, this is probably for overseas. You know, this isn't going to be seen so much in Japan, so it doesn't really matter. I think also my friend Jeffrey, who was running the interviews, is very empathetic, compassionate guy who just is really engaged. Not cold at all. It's not a job for him. This is just kind of, he really wants to get to know these people. So he had a certain amount of charm of helping these people to relax. And then beyond all of that, I mean, the event is so huge. What I found really interesting in all my trips, because I've been back a few times, in all my trips up to Tohoku, these people have lost so much that all of that Japanese convention has kind of, they're quite happy to put that to one side and just say, no, we've been through hell. We're going to tell you how it is. They're not, I mean, that's nothing to do with us. They're just, that's just the space that they're in. You give them an opportunity and they'll talk. That's that simple, I think.
Did you get the feeling that many of them want to leave the city, or do they want to stay and try to rebuild it, or what's the situation like?
Yeah, this was something I tried to get them to explain a number of times as well, because they can't leave. This is one of the really, I mean, people are leaving, but really they can't, or they don't want to leave. And it just goes back. I was in a town that was quite badly hit further north than Ishinomaki, and there were fishermen who were just starting to get back to work. They were wakame fishermen. And then you could see that there was a kid running around who was working there. There was like four generations all at work together, and this youngest kid was like 7 or 8 years old, and he was like a 14th generation wakame farmer. And that's kind of, so it's very much in the psyche that this is where they come from, and they really struggled to kind of leave. And I tried to get one of our interview subjects to explain it once, and he was like, okay, say somebody wanted to just go to Tokyo to get out. It's not the individual's decision. They have to go to the rest of their family, and they all have to kind of talk about it together and work it out together and make a kind of group decision, right?
Right.
Which I think is it's kind of a Japanese cultural thing, and it's strongest, I guess, in the family then.
Right.
And so a lot of people struggle to, they don't even want to address it, I guess, or they don't want to kind of cause conflict, I guess, within their own family unit by bringing it up, or
right.
It's really hard for a lot of us to get our heads around it, especially for me. I'm from Australia. We don't really have, you know, deep roots with the country if you're not kind of an original Australian. So,
right.
So it's kind of, for me, I don't get it. I just think you've lost everything. It's just material stuff, you know, it's time to move on. But they have a different kind of connection to their land, I guess, or to their place, the sense of home or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I've actually kind of noticed that theme in many of the interviews I do with Japanese people. I think that they do have this feeling, this connection with Japan, with their land, with the nature. And you know, I come from Canada, and Canada is similar to Australia. I mean, I could live in any part of Canada. It doesn't really matter to me. Toronto to Vancouver, it's the same thing. But I think for many Japanese people, you know, like, to them, their Japan is their town.
Yeah.
And Tokyo is a different kind of Japan.
Yeah, Tokyo is a little bubble of modernity or the city, definitely.
Right.
Yeah, I totally agree.
One of the characters that I found most interesting was Fujita-san. He was quite prominent in your film. Can you tell us how you found him?
Yeah, Jeffrey, that was our first point of contact. Jeffrey Josan, who was with us on the shoot, had been making some runs up with trucks with supplies on numerous occasions. And he'd been delivering stuff to this, what's it called, a kaikan, like a community center,
okay,
called Ganahama Kaikan.
Right.
And he'd been delivering stuff there, and this little community center had become kind of the home base for everyone in that, the nearest surrounding kind of 5 to 6 blocks, I guess. It was kind of it had been underwater and everything, but everyone had kind of rallied together, cleaned up this little building, and then that became the center of operations for distributing aid and things like that for this immediate area. And Fujita-san had kind of risen to the task of organizing stuff and just trying to make sure that people were being looked after. And he's really been fired up. I mean, you hear in the film he lost both his mother and his auntie were taken right in front of his eyes.
Right.
He lived on his roof for 3 days afterwards, and then he was down in the water. It took 3 days for the water to recede, and he was down in the water kind of trying to get around and check out how other people were going and fishing for supplies and all kinds of stuff, right? So he kind of had a really traumatic experience. And then the part of town he's living in is a little bit out of the way. It was kind of off to the side in a way from where a lot of the aid was being delivered. The peace boat and other people were up there, but they weren't aware that there was this little pocket in Korganahama where people needed help. And so he tells a story that he stood in front of a food supply truck that was, I think it was connected to peace boat. He stood in front of him like the classic shot of the guy in front of the tank in the China Tiananmen Square thing. Right, he kind of stopped right in front of them and was like, "You guys have to go. You have to turn right now. You have to go over there. There's people over there who don't have any food, you know." And these guys in the peace boat were like, "Well, we're supposed to go left to those guys over there." And he's like, no. It's been like days and they've got nothing. You've got to do it." And then he's been into the local government offices, giving them hell about who needed what. And so he really, I don't know if he was like that before. We never met him before the event, but he's really just, what do you call it? He's just got this spark at the moment. He does have this kind of leadership quality, but
do you know what his job was before he this all has happened? What was his profession before? Do you know?
He was he tells us he was about to study to be a doctor.
Okay.
Because he heard that, this is interesting, because he heard that down in Okinawa there was a shortage of doctors. So he wanted to go down to Okinawa and be a doctor. And then all of this kind of happened, and now he's in Ishinomaki helping his local community. And it's sort of like, what happened to the Okinawa dream? Do you just drop that? And I guess he just kind of dropped it. But beyond that, that's the story he told us about before. I don't actually know other work that he was doing before. I think there was some community worker kind of some kind of community aid stuff that he was doing before as right. well.
Right. Wow, interesting. You know, the one thing that kind of I noticed about in the interviews with Fujita-san and some of the other people, what really actually struck me was how entrepreneurial they seem to be in getting back their lives again. You know, like the gentleman who lost everything and then was selling ramen from the truck.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, watching that, their interviews – and you'd almost would kind of think that it's not so bad now, right?
Yeah.
They weren't crying. They weren't upset. They seemed, you know, quite content almost with their situation.
Yeah.
What was it like when you shut the camera off?
No, it was the same. It does, it's hard to say. I kept going back there to try and film again and see what the change had been. And I do think there was this period over the first year, there was this period of shock, right? And we went up and filmed. We actually, the music in the film was a harpist playing. And when it came around to the 1 year anniversary, we thought, why don't we just take her up there and play harp for a kind of service that they were having in this community center.
Right.
So we went up and she gave a concert and stuff. It was really great. And then it was a nice day, and Fujita-san was he was quite cranky in the morning actually, and then he was like, no, today has to be forward looking, and there was all this pressure, and there was this feeling of like, how much has this work? How much is he hiding through doing this work and helping everyone else? How much is he just kind of bottling his own grieving? And there was this definite sense of I was quite concerned, and a lot of people were concerned that it just felt like possibly something was going to snap at some point, right?
Right.
But then after that year, and someone else has said it to me as well, for the Japanese, there is a kind of year of mourning that everyone's supposed to acknowledge. Like, you don't send anyone a Happy New Year's card if they're still in a year of mourning from someone that died the year before. And there's things like that, right? And once that year was over, there was a few things that happened. A lot of people apparently died. A lot of older people had kind of survived the tsunami, made it through that year, and then realized there wasn't really anything more to live for.
Right.
So this is, you know, these are kind of the frail and the really the elderly.
Right.
And then in another sense, I think some of this edge of openness and stuff that we did capture in Then and Now, I think some of that started maybe disappearing a bit, and people started going back to their old ways of, yeah, kind of the old local politics and stuff started to come out again, you know, because there was definitely this period after the tsunami where people dropped all of the kind of past grievances you might have had with your neighbor or whatever, and just like let's help each other. But I think a year later, I think some of the old politics starts coming out again, and I think Fujita-san's had a bit of difficulty in a way, because he's trying to run a bunch of things. He's a bit of a cowboy in that he wants to get things done and he doesn't want to go through traditional channels and things like that. But the more time that goes on, the more people start wanting to go back to the old ways and do things the proper Japanese way. And that kind of maybe frustrates him, and it tests a few relationships there. And yeah.
We don't want people to think that everything is all okay there, right? Because it's, you know, watching that film, watching just the interviews, you could kind of look at that and go, wow, you know, it sounds like everything's picking up. But actually the situation is not really like that, is it?
No, the situation's tough for sure. I mean, I haven't been there myself now for a few months. And there was a lot. I mean, it was good to see some of the shopping center. They started to reopen some little kind of temporary shops, and there seemed to be more activity. There seemed to be more people down there, but it sort of depended on the day, I guess. We were there once where there was a kind of a special event. So people had kind of come from all over Japan, and there was some activity. But then on other times I've been there, and it was just another day in Ishinomaki, and it was just, you just notice how quiet it was, right? Because they've kind of been hit twice, because already all these towns in Japan are getting older. People are leaving to go and work in Tokyo and that sort of thing. That was already the kind of demographics that were happening. And then after the tsunami came and sort of a lot of people died and whatever, that kind of it's like a double hit. It made the town was already struggling in a sense,
right?
And now the town is kind of struggling even more. So, but the thing that's most obvious when you're there is just how empty it is compared to, you know, how many buildings are actually, how many shops are shut,
right?
And that sort of thing. It doesn't give you the impression that the place is exactly thriving,
right?
But out of what's happened since, I still think they've. I mean, economically, I don't know how people are doing, but I think people have crossed a certain line now, and they've managed to piece together their lives to a certain extent that it's functional. You know, it's right. Not they're not living in abject poverty, but they might not have it as good as they did, I guess. I mean, the last time I remember, I was there in spring, and then I really noticed out in the suburbs how many houses were really being patched up. Mm. There were quite a lot of properties that there's a lot of empty lots where houses were completely demolished, but then there were a lot of kind of scaffolding sets around houses that were, you know, activity was happening. There were builders there, they were doing stuff, and that was a stark contrast to just 2 or 3 months before that. I was up there in February, I think. And then it was winter and it was bleak and it was really empty. And yeah, that was something else. So I definitely, when I was there in spring and around the time of the anniversary, did get a feeling that there was some momentum there, and that people were had made their choice of whether to rebuild or not, and they were kind of following through on their plans.
That's interesting. Well, I hope they're able to do that, because you kind of got the sense through your film that they do want to rebuild, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit kind of really starting to grow, and everyone wants to work hard to rebuild what they had before.
Yeah, I think that's true. The energy is definitely there, right? The determination is there.
Right.
But the kind of economic realities of that, I guess they're going to hit home over a matter of years. It's not something you're going to know immediately, you know, and it's right. still, yeah, I mean, it's a huge task to rebuild the town. So
right.
a lot of the decisions, as I understood it, a lot of the decisions hadn't been made at the government level about certain areas where they would never rebuild again, and what were they going to do with these areas that were sort of half destroyed, half not destroyed. And there were a lot of kind of decisions that needed to be made at the government level before people had a clear enough signal to be able to follow through on their own plans. There were still a lot of people in that gray area.
Right. Okay.
But that was part of filming. Once we filmed the first interviews, I mean, the enormity of the whole situation really hit us. So then I really wanted to – I saw that the story that is unfolding here is it's a really long-term thing, right?
Right.
I could not be there now for 2 years. I could go back in 2 or 3 years, and there's going to be some things that are exactly as they were when I left, and there's going to be some other little pockets of hope and inspiration as well, I think, that things are picking up. But that you know, if you're talking about the town as a whole – rebuilding a whole town, that's going to take a really long time.
Right. Have the residents of Ishinomaki seen your film?
Yeah. How did we do that? They've seen it. We've sent them links. I don't think we've had a screening up there yet. We didn't.
Did you get any feedback from them about what they thought of the film?
Oh, they love it. Yeah, everyone's – I mean, I've been going back, right, multiple times. And right. and whenever I go back, I'm welcomed with open arms. So they're really happy that their story has been taken elsewhere. Yeah. Another time we had Fujita-san, we brought him down to Tokyo as part of actually, it was more like an anti-nuclear event, a Namida project,
right.
it's called. And that was more like – what are we going to do since Fukushima? But he came down to present, you know, what's happening in a town that has been hit by a tsunami, like Ishinomaki. Mm. He wanted to bring, he was that voice, I guess, at that event. And so he watched the film then and had a chance to relate with people in Tokyo. And that was really great.
And how has the film been received around the world? I know it's available on YouTube and Vimeo and a few other places. What has been the response to the film for you?
There's been a lot of surprises with the film since we just put it online and let it go kind of viral. We've had first we put it on this Vimeo.com. We ended up with 20, 30,000 hits within a month or something. It ended up on YouTube, and it's now had well over 300,000 hits and a lot of Japanese watchers. And reading the comments section in there has been really interesting, because there's a lot of discussion amongst all the kind of viewers, the Japanese viewers, about the politics in their own country and stuff. And I think that's really great.
Mm.
And then once the film was online, we started getting interest from all corners of the earth, of people that wanted to help or people that wanted to do stuff. And we got one example is a couple that were living in Germany, but they'd lived in Japan before. They saw the film and said, "That's it, we're moving to Ishinomaki."
Wow.
And they did. Like a month later, they moved to Ishinomaki. And then a lady in Australia runs a Japanese art gallery, and they'd had an opening for their gallery on the same day as a tsunami. So they had a lot of Japanese people there on the day. And phones started ringing, and they kind of lived through this whole drama in real time, and they felt a very strong connection to that. So a year later, they wanted to have a fundraising event, and they also wanted to try and have some kind of direct connection to a community in Japan where they could give the funds to someone directly. So they showed the film, and I did a little Skype interview and showed them some more recent footage. And they got together over ¥1 million and they brought it over and handed it over to Fujita-san. So that was great. We followed them, and that might end up as part of the documentary as well later down the track. And
right.
and then another example, this email arrived one day and it just said, "Oh, I loved your film. I think it's really great. More people need to see it. And therefore I've translated all your subtitles into Portuguese. Here's the text file."
Wow.
So, I just, yeah, I put all the subtitles in Portuguese. I had a friend in Japan who was Portuguese, so he could read them and just check, and yeah, it was all good. So it ended up like that. Another fundraiser happened in Switzerland, so that meant that we ended up with an Italian version of the film as well.
Wow.
Mm.
It's interesting how the film has managed to connect with so many people around the world. You know, like this town, Nishinomaki, has a population of 160,000. It's really small.
Yeah.
But this I guess the struggle, and I think like we mentioned earlier, like the characters in the film really, really make it. You know, like
yeah.
the fact that they're, you know, they've gone through this stuff, they're open in the film, you can sense they're wanting to rebuild, doing what they can with what they have. And I think that message connects with a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. The openness and the honesty of them, it just resonates. Definitely. And
right.
the imagery speaks for itself. You don't need them to describe how difficult it is. You see what they're up against, I guess.
Right.
So yeah, it's very inspiring. It was a really inspiring project to be involved on, and it's clear that it communicates that to anyone who watches the film. So that's from our end, it's such a win-win project all the way around. You know, we just went up there to try and see if we could do something interesting, something positive out of a kind of dire situation, and what we came away with just blew our minds, and it seems to be really connecting with people all over the world.
Thanks again to my guest this week, Mr. Paul Johannesson, for coming on the show and talking about his latest film, Ishinomaki, Then and Now. You can view his documentary on YouTube or on Vimeo, and I'll also embed it into my website at tokyopodcast.com. I highly recommend checking out this film, because like we talked about, it's more than just a film about the disaster that happened there. It's really kind of a life story about what these people are going through and the recovery efforts. He's also completed a second documentary titled Women of Fukushima. And in this documentary, he interviewed six women who are from that area who offer their opinion and view about the state of the cleanup, the government cover-ups, and the lies that were told to them by the authorities. And kind of gives a more of a deeper look into what the lives of these people are like living in this particular area. So if you want to check that out, you can find them online at Women of Fukushima, and I'll also post a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Anthony Joe, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.